We are talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right, starting with local and settlement of a CHOP-related lawsuit.
Yeah, this week the City of Seattle Attorney's Office agreed to a settlement with the father of Lorenzo Anderson, who was shot in the Capitol Hill-occupied protest zone in June of 2020. The city will pay around $500,000 to Anderson's father as part of the settlement. Now, the lawsuit was filed against the city, former Mayor Jenny Durkan and Councilmember Shama Sawant. It alleged that the city had encouraged the formation of the CHOP and allowed protesters within the CHOP zone to undermine the safety of others. Now, in particular, the lawsuit pointed to the fact that police would not enter the CHOP to provide safe passage for medics to reach Lorenzo Anderson after he'd been shot. Anderson was treated by protesters while medic units waited at the boundaries of the CHOP, repeatedly calling the Seattle Police Department to get assistance so they could enter. Police ended up going to the boundary of the CHOP, but not meeting the medics at the correct meeting place. Okay. And it took them more than 20 minutes to actually arrive. Eventually, protesters decided to load Anderson into the back of a pickup truck and drive him to Harborview themselves. Okay. The lawsuit contended that Anderson bled to death on a table in the CHOP zone while protesters were trying to help him, and that he could have been saved if medics had immediately entered the CHOP zone. And there is actually footage from that night taken by civilians who were there showing that people inside the CHOP zone were begging medics to enter the zone to help Anderson and that they wouldn't do it. Now, the settlement was approved by a judge in April, but is just being announced now. The second lawsuit regarding the CHOP zone was brought by Anderson's mother, Donita Sinclair, in federal court, not in state court like this lawsuit. But it was dismissed by a federal judge and is being appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. So that one is still hanging out there. And I also want to mention, too, that it's in the news this morning that the city has also settled a lawsuit over the murder of Isaiah Falatogo in 2018. He is a young Pacific Islander man who was targeted by police because he looked, quote unquote, shady. Okay. So essentially he was racially profiled by Seattle police who pursued him, tackled him to the ground. He did have a gun on him, but the gun was on the ground when one of the officers yelled at him, don't pull your weapon, and then shot him in the back of the head. Okay. So he was he was both racially profiled and he was summarily executed by a police officer. That police officer, rather than facing discipline, left the Seattle Police Department and is now employed by the Spokane Police Department. Yeah. So he is one of the reasons why the state legislature had been working not this year but last year on trying to set up an office that would track officers with these kinds of complaints against them throughout the state so that an officer couldn't just avoid discipline in one department by quitting his job and going to another police department in the state. So the settlement in that case again was about $500,000. So that case has, that lawsuit has also been settled.
There's kind of a trend here.
Yeah, you see the trend.
I mean, you wonder how much a year settling misconduct lawsuits against SPD cost the city and cost taxpayers.
Oh yeah, yeah, and we'll see a little bit about that here in just a minute. First, I think I'd like to slip in there some news that made big headlines this week. That Mayor Harrell vetoed Council Bill 120325, which would have collected information on rents in Seattle from landlords. The city council passed that bill last week in a 5-4 vote with council members Juarez, who is council president, Teresa Mosqueda, Sarah Nelson, and Dan Strauss voting against it. Now, Juarez and Mosqueda cited worries about the cost of implementing the program, and Sarah Nelson worries about requiring landlords to report any information at all, which she termed proprietary information to a governmental agency. Now, Mayor Bruce Harrell jumped on that bandwagon this week, and he vetoed the bill, knowing that, of course, it won't get the 6 votes that it needs from the city council to override his veto. He cited a letter from James Young, who is the director of the University of Washington's Center for Real Estate Research. Harrell said that Young had several reasons for not liking the bill, and then Harrell attached a copy of Young's letter to his veto. But I read Young's letter, and it only cites 2 objections to the bill. The first is that landlords would be required to report information, okay? They would be required to report this information. He favors instead a voluntary program, and he made a dubious argument that requiring landlords to report data would lead to, quote-unquote, incomplete or inaccurate data, end quote, when I found that to be a real head scratcher, because it's obvious to me that a voluntary program would lead to incomplete and therefore inaccurate data. So I didn't quite understand what he was going for there. His logic kind of escaped me. Okay. And then his second objection, of only 2 objections that he cited, is that his own agency, the Center for Real Estate Research, which the council had envisioned would jump in and set up this program, his own agency is not a good agency to collect that data, is what he said, and that it should be a private business doing it instead, and that the city council should appeal to private businesses to set up something. Please set up something. Essentially. And again, that's another head scratcher, because he goes on then in his letter, very same letter, just, you know, a different paragraph, to describe the purpose of his agency. And he says the purpose is to provide credible research, value-added information, education services, and project-oriented research, which would seem to make it the ideal agency to collect this kind of information. And he also offers the services later in the letter. He also offers the services of his center to help the city council study the issue, right? Because his center, he describes his center as, quote, a neutral party whose only interest is in reliable data. Okay.
They vetoed any possibility of reliable data.
Yeah, so he's saying,
help me understand this.
Yeah, exactly. I read through this and I'm like, this makes no sense. So I went to the website for the Washington Center for Real Estate Research, because generally when someone like that who heads up a agency and writes a letter that makes no sense and contradicts itself is got some underlying conflicts that are not apparent, okay? So I looked at the website to see what the problem is. And you can see right there, the center was established to be a bridge between the state-owned university system, so the University of Washington and Washington State University, et cetera, and its research faculty and the real estate industry. In other words, real estate developers and landlords. So Young is meant to be like a networker, somebody who facilitates discussion between professors at the University of Washington who are doing research on real estate issues and the private real estate industry, real estate developers, landlords, et cetera. So he's opposed to the bill because he has to maintain a friendly relationship with landlords and big real estate developers in Seattle. And he doesn't want to take on any role that would cause them to grumble, oh no, you know, why are we forced to report this to you and you're doing it for the city and now we don't trust you, you know, but I want to, like I said last week, I want to point out that the real estate industry already does a certain amount of required reporting to King County government whenever they purchase or sell a property. Okay. reporting rents and the square footage of units would not be burdensome in comparison. It would just be, you know, part of what they would have, what landlords would have to do, not something that, you know, requires hours of work. Okay.
Yeah, because theoretically they already have all this recorded somewhere, like on a database
theoretically,
or spreadsheet.
They already have it. Yeah. Yeah, they already have it. They're already tracking.
Yeah, they're not this. Creating something new.
And they don't have to surrender to the research agency, you know, spreadsheets or the complete information on how, what their profits are, you know, what their expenses are or anything. Just, you know, what type of units do you offer for rent? What are their size and what's the going rate for rent? You know, what are your?
That's proprietary information. Only tenants are allowed to be subjected to that.
Yeah, exactly. Only tenants are allowed to be subjected to that and only the rent that they pay so that they can't compare it to anybody else. And so that there are no eyes on the market. Now, as for the cost factor, the, office, I believe it was the Office of Housing. There were a couple of departments in the city that made a presentation to the city council that said that they thought a program like this would cost between $2 million to $5 million to set it up and run it. And that's not expensive for a program like this. In fact, you could pay for it with the excess money in the Seattle Police Department's salary budget.
Yeah.
I'm just saying $4.5 million sitting there, right? But Bruce Harrell vetoed it anyway. I think really putting the lie to his claim that he believes more data is better when it comes to Seattle's housing and homelessness crisis.
Okay. Only if the data is something that, you know, can be used by landlords.
Yeah, well, it's only it's like I've said in the past, it's not, it's His attitude is it's not burdensome for homeless people to continually be filling out forms and answering a long list of personally invasive questions every time they have any contact with a service provider. But it's definitely burdensome for landlords to provide even the most basic information about the rents they charge. That is Harrell's attitude.
That's because landlords' time is valuable. Homeless people's time has no value whatsoever. So we're going to make them spend all their time rather than, say, trying to find permanent housing, trying to fill out forms.
Yeah, we're going to make instead of trying to get their lives in some kind of order and trying to deal with health issues and issues with not having their identification anymore because they lost it in a sweep, et cetera. Which puts in place a huge hurdle for most homeless people when they lose important documents. Instead of, you know, helping them with that and trying to have them spend their time on something important, we're going to have them answer questions over and over again about, you know, do you drink? Do you do illegal drugs? You know, do you have any family who live? What was your last place where you lived? Because of course we have to prove over and over again to right wing pundits and neighborhood NIMBYs that the people who are homeless in Seattle, yes, actually lived in Washington State. And more importantly, actually lived somewhere in King County before they became homeless, because there's this myth that Seattle is a great place for homeless people around the nation to come to in order to get services, right?
Yeah, and that myth shows up in a lot of different parts of the country. It's not unique mm-hmm. to Seattle.
It's not unique to here.
California, that's like...
That's another, yeah.
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 Florida, et cetera. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, just asking landlords to give the most basic information about the rental market is too burdensome, but it's not burdensome to keep asking homeless people the same stupid, personally invasive questions, you know, to try to counteract the myths perpetrated by, you know, right wing people about who the homeless are.
So
and that's a huge double standard. So of course he vetoed it. And if the city council wants to put something like this in place again, they're going to have to come up with a separate, a new bill or a revised bill and vote again. In the meantime, we're kind of at the mercy of James Young's notion of, oh, private industry, please help, you know, somebody somewhere set up and collect this information, spend the money to set up a way to collect this information and start doing it. That's never going to happen.
Of course, on the wild off chance that nothing like this happens, it's just forgotten. There's no accountability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's nothing here that a public-private partnership can't prolong further.
Yeah. And, you know, this kind of speaks to this whole notion that the publicly funded universities exist to help private industry and to form these public-private partnerships with private industry rather than to help the public good by doing very basic kinds of research like collecting this data, right?
You know, have you seen the University of Washington's campus recently and all the new buildings going up?
Mm-hmm.
Those buildings are going up because they do important research in conjunction with private corporations.
And a lot of it is paid for with private money, which is why you see the names of tech billionaires on them. Just saying. On those buildings. So anyway. So let's talk about the police accountability news this week.
Okay.
There was a lot of it.
There was. Carolyn Bick at the South Seattle Emerald broke the news that former police chief Carmen Best released a video to SPD officers on the morning of June 11th, 2020. That was during the George Floyd protests, that described reports of armed people patrolling the CHOP zone and shaking down residents and business owners and demanding to see people's IDs. But there was a big problem with that video that she released to SPD officers. Best recorded it knowing that what she was saying was a lie. Okay. She recorded it. She released it. She knew it was not true. Okay. This is the police chief's briefing to officers on the morning of June 11th, 2020. Because 17 hours prior to that, Carmen Best had received and been briefed on a report by a member of her own management team at SPD that debunked all of those claims, okay? So she released that video knowing that it was absolutely not true. And later that same morning, the Seattle Police Department released the video publicly, claiming that it had already been leaked. And I have to point out that there was no solid proof of that. Okay.
And local media ran with it.
Oh, yeah. And what we also know is that the conservative media all over the United States picked up that video and reported it as fact. And in some cases, they mocked up their own false videos to depict what they thought was happening in the CHOP zone. Okay. In fact, the briefing that Best received 17 hours earlier said in bright red letters, okay, this is a quote from it. Upon talking with every business that is open inside the perimeter and several on the outside, they're talking about the CHOP zone, almost all say that they have been treated well and respectfully. No shakedowns, no ID requested. A hot dog vendor at 12th and Pine, who is out there every night till around 9, stated he has not seen any ID checks, barrier turnbacks, he's next to one, or weapons, end quote. That was in bright red letters in the briefing Best received. And Best was not the only city employee.
And he was doing good business too.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And I was down there the first week of June and there were lots of crowds. It was almost like a festival environment. Lots of sort of ordinary, you know, not people who look like they were packing heat or shaking people down. Lots of sort of ordinary everyday people of all ages, kids, you know, older folks, mom and pop, you know, it was not at all this kind of sort of mafia run place like Best was saying. And, you know, she was not the only city employee to receive that briefing with that information in red letters. It also went to Deputy Mayor Casey Sixkiller, Durkin's Chief of Staff Stephanie Formas, who was her lead liaison with folks inside the CHOP. Durkin's public safety advisor, Julie Klein, Fire Chief Harold Scoggins, Seattle Parks Chief Jesus Aguirre, SDOT Director Sam Zimbabwe, and many, many other members of the mayor's staff and heads of city departments. Not one of them stepped forward to contradict Best's lies when she released that video. Now, notably, around the same time that Carmen Best released her lying video, the Greater Seattle Business Association posted a tweet, okay, just a few hours, actually, before that, that said they had done their own survey with the Capitol Hill Business Association and found no evidence to support rumors of shakedowns and ID checks. Rumors that had been spread initially by a Seattle Police Department spokesperson, Deanna Nolette, at a press conference the day before on June 10th. Again, that rumor came initially from an SPD spokesperson, and Best just ran with it, even though she knew it was absolutely untrue. Okay. Now, also in the news this week, of all the complaints that the OPA has investigated resulting from the Seattle Police Department response to the George Floyd protests, this week, Publicola reported that there are still three cases that the OPA has declined to investigate because of a conflict of interest. Now, those three cases are, one, the complaint that the city never investigated former police chief Carmen Best for lying about armed people running a shakedown in the CHOP, which we just talked about. The second complaint is a complaint that, again, former police chief Carmen Best lied when she said that protesters had blocked the path of emergency vehicles trying to reach Lorenzo Anderson after he was shot in the CHOP. Okay. And this was proved to be untrue because it was picked up, and it was also picked up by right-wing media. KUOW reviewed the actual police videos, the 911 dispatch recordings, and witness testimony to uncover that the Seattle police and firefighters messed up, miscommunicated, and didn't meet each other at the correct place to enter the CHOP together, per Seattle emergency response policies. And again, you can see that in private videos taken online by folks who were there at the time, where people inside the CHOP were begging medics to enter the zone to pick up Anderson. Okay. So Best lied about that, and that's the second complaint that the OPA has not investigated. And the third complaint involves the Seattle Police Department continuing to use tear gas against George Floyd protesters after former police chief Carmen Best supposedly issued a ban against it. And this was widely complained about at the time.
I can remember our talking about it on the air at the time. It was not a secret at all.
It was not a secret. Now, the OPA refused to hear those cases because it would essentially be investigating the boss and be a true conflict of interest. I think
it would make the police look bad.
Basically. Yeah, well, and I think that's also an indication of who the OPA views as their real boss, right? It's the chief of police and the SPD management. It's not the Seattle public, right? So instead, the OPA initially referred those three cases to Mayor Jenny Durkin, who said that she wanted to have the Office of the Inspector General of the Seattle Police Department, the OIG, investigate them. But the OIG also refused to take up the cases. Again, an indication of who they feel their real boss is, right?
Well, their real boss was Durkin.
Yeah. And I think it's very clear that in investigating those cases, Durkin would get roped into the investigation as someone also culpable. Right. So the OPA then requested from Durkin that those three cases be assigned to an outside agency to investigate. Right. But Durkin sat on them instead. She just kind of buried them for a year and a half, and they were
shocked.
Yeah, and they were not assigned to an outside agency until Bruce Harrell took office in January and realized that there were three cases left over from the George Floyd protests that had not had any action taken on them. So you can really see that there was a cover up going on during the Durkin administration to protect both former police chief Carmen Best and Jenny Durkin. Okay, this week, City Council member Lisa Herbold, who is also the chair of the Public Safety and Human Services Committee, introduced a draft bill that would prevent the OPA and the mayor from letting cases like this languish. It sets up a formal process with various steps and deadlines that have to be met. It takes all, and I think most importantly, it takes all decision making out of the hands of the mayor, and it empowers the OPA and the OIG to consult with the new Washington State Office of Independent Investigations to identify an outside agency to investigate cases like this if there's a conflict of interest, like there is in these three cases. That bill number is Council Bill 120337. And it's on the agenda for the June 14th, that's this coming Tuesday morning, meeting of the Public Safety and Human Services Committee. So that's worth looking into if you're interested in that. You can go to the City Council's website, click on the link to agendas to see agendas for the different committees, and look for the June 14th Tuesday morning meeting of the Public Safety and Human Services Committee. You can click on the agenda and get a copy of that bill and read the details if you want.
Aren't they going to be also voting on the upcoming contract with?
Yes, I was going to say also at that meeting, the committee will review a presentation by a member of the council central staff on the first quarter financial report from the Seattle Police Department. And they'll be they won't be looking at the SPEMA contract. That'll be the afternoon session with the full council. So okay. Not the public safety. They've already kind of referred it on. Yeah. The public safety committee will be looking at the first quarter financial report from the Seattle Police Department. I reviewed the slides for the presentation. It's going to be a council central staff member who does the presentation. And it's really the slides are a summary of the top level financials and performance stats for the SPD. And it, of course, it shows the $4.5 million salary savings. And it mentions that there may be additional savings in the overtime budget category because a lot of special events have not resumed yet because of the COVID-19 surge. There are some other items of interest in the slides that they may be discussing. The SPD was expecting 24 officers to leave or retire in the first 3 months of this year. Instead, they've lost 43 officers total. So that is what is accounting for that $4.5 million in salary savings. Now, the SPD has already spent 60% of its annual budget on services and on services / consultants. And that includes legal fees. They've spent about $433,000. When it comes to legal fees, right? We were just talking about that. I'm sure the city attorney's office and the city's legal budget has taken some big hits because of issues with SPD, but the SPD budget directly is taking a big hit as well. Now, the SPD has already spent.
Do we have any of the figures for past years? Do we know if that runs over budget routinely, for example?
Not in these slides that are going to be presented this coming week, but you can guess that the budget is based on prior years, right? Typically, when you do a budget, you look at what you spent in prior years and you come up with what you think is a reasonable amount. And with the SPD already having spent 60% of its entire yearly budget in the first quarter on consulting fees, particularly legal fees, that tells you something, right? Okay, they've already spent 58% of their annual budget for discretionary purchases, a total of about $600,000. Again, those are discretionary purchases that they didn't have to tell the city council what they would be spending that money on. They just spend it as they go. They've already spent 58% of it. Now, the category, when it comes to overtime hours, the category with the highest overtime hours in it is miscellaneous, which includes the emphasis patrols that Bruce Harrell and Interim Chief Adrian Diaz were touting earlier this year. So rather than calling that patrol hours, that's just miscellaneous overtime is being spent on that. significant number of overtime hours are also being spent on special events and sporting events, about one third of the total. And I know I've mentioned in the past that if there's one thing you can give to a civilian team, yeah, it should be things like directing traffic and sporting events and special events, right? Here we see that the Seattle Police Department is paying officers overtime to do those, okay? Now, response times are also, there's also a couple of slides on response times. Response times to the most urgent category of 911 calls are up by about 1 minute. Unless you're looking at the Southwest precinct, where response times are up by 2 minutes. And I should point out that this is the precinct that covers Councilmember Lisa Herbold's district, and she is the chair of the Public Safety Committee. Clearly, the SPD hates her, and I think that might account for the fact that response times are slower in her district. Now, I'm sure that in this upcoming Tuesday meeting, there's going to be some discussion about the response times. There certainly should be some discussion about the recent report that the Seattle Police Department is not investigating new sexual assault cases. Okay, that should definitely be part of the discussion. And, of course, there will be discussions about the budget, but they'll get boiled down to Sarah Nelson demanding a blank check for the SPD to top up these categories where they've spent, you know, 50 to 60% of their annual budget already. And of course, Teresa Mosqueda will then, she's the budget chair. She's also on this public safety committee, and she's going to push back on that for sure. And I'm hoping she brings up yet again, why are we not assigning some of these duties to civilian teams? So, and then of course later on Tuesday at 2 p.m., the full council will discuss and vote on Council Bill 120332. That's the new bargaining agreement with the Seattle Police Management Association. They were going to do that last Tuesday, but the bill was tabled to give council members more time to read through the draft agreement. And I just want to say, yes, never pass a bill that you have not read. And I think we have to put that action down to the fact that so many people gave public comment and sent emails to their city council members saying, hey, there are things to object to in this draft agreement and you need to take a closer look. Yeah. So,
we've enumerated several of those in past.
We did. And, if you want to give public comment, there will be public comment at the 2 p.m. meeting on Tuesday of the full city council. You should sign up well before it starts. And I would encourage you to, give public comment on the Seattle Police Management Association draft contract. Again, that is Council Bill 120332. And then in other city council news, very quickly, on Wednesday morning, the Finance and Housing Committee will meet, and the committee will discuss amendments to the city's housing funding policies document that the Seattle Office of Housing uses in choosing affordable housing projects to fund. The amendments would add the new Jumpstart payroll tax funds and set up a program for allocating and dispersing those funds to new projects, and details on how the program will be administered. And then that committee will also discuss Council Bill 120338, which would add a little over $3 million in funding from Washington State and the federal government to the 2022 budget for the Human Services Department, mostly for things like low-income housing, for elder care, particularly elders who have been treated for COVID-19 and need supportive housing and supportive care, and also for nutrition programs. So that committee is headed by Councilmember Teresa Mosqueda. So that is what's on the docket so far for the city council this coming week.
And finally, there was the OPA director.
Yes, one more bit of police accountability news. There was.
I've got one too.
Oh, okay.
And it's in Pierce County.
Okay, there was the OPA candidate forum, which was announced kind of at the very last minute, and questions taken from the public at the very last minute. Nevertheless, the city received 150 questions from the public, which they then boiled down to just six. for each candidate. And of course, they filmed it. You can find the video on the Seattle channel. I watched the video last night because I was not able to join and watch the candidate forum held at the last minute with almost no public announcements of it. And I kind of listened to the different candidates and found that two of them are, one of them is quite dreadful. That would be Valesa Nash. She knows the police perspective, and that's about it. And her stance seems to be that she would make the OPA an agency that the police and police union could trust. I found that to be quite dreadful and particularly terrible that the interviewer had to prompt her in order to get her to answer many of the questions and to kind of give her little clues as to what the questions were about so that she could understand why people were asking them. That's just dreadful. Okay. And then Janelle Harris was okay, but she really gave up she really showed that this was not an actual candidate forum. It was not an actual job interview. It was a staged event because she sat there and she, every time a question was asked, she picked up her papers and held them in front of her face and read her answers that she had, that she had written the answers for ahead of time. So clearly the six questions were pulled out and then forwarded to the candidates so that they could prepare for this staged event. Right.
Right. And, but I don't think that should be held against her.
No, it shouldn't be held against her. But, you know, she really came across as somebody who was not thinking through the questions and responding to them off the cuff. She was actually way better than Valesa Nash. But again, you know, I was I was not terribly impressed with her. Eddie Aubrey came across as much more relaxed and quite excited about potentially running the Office of Police Accountability. But to me, the candidate that stood out head and shoulders above everybody else was Gino Betts. He's the assistant state attorney at the Community Justice Center in the Cook County State Attorney's Office in Chicago. I thought he was much more knowledgeable about the situation here in Seattle. He cited the police union, where he works, the police union as one of the main impediments to police reform. And I would say that that is absolutely spot on the correct answer here in the city of Seattle as well. And he did not seem to me to be somebody who would be appeasing the SPD or SPOG in that position. So I was, you know, very favorably impressed with Gino Betts. But of course, some of my impression may have been because I had listened to, he was the last candidate and I'd listened to, right before him, the most dreadful of the three, Valesa Nash. So take that with a grain of salt. And if you want to, watch that again, it's on the Seattle channel. You can just Google the Seattle channel and you can go there and the video is there. You can watch the video. There is also a link there to give the city feedback on these candidates and to kind of tell them who you would think would be the best candidate to run the Office of Police Accountability. And I think people should do that as well.
All right. Moving on to County Here's South County. Of us and Ed Troyer making the news again.
Yeah, people and the question of the week, why does Ed Troyer still have a job? And the answer is because the sheriff of Pierce County is an elected office. And this underscores why King County got rid of the sheriff as an elected office and is now appointed again. Because you can't fire somebody who engages in gross conduct. In the case of Troyer, he has refused to resign after the January 2021 incident in which he harassed a black newspaper carrier by calling dispatch and saying that the man was trying to kill him. So about 40 officers from different agencies descended upon this guy. Who was doing nothing of the kind. He was delivering newspapers to different, you know, residences and trying to do his job. And Troyer apparently racially profiled him and then upped the ante by claiming that he himself was being attacked, which he told investigators on the scene that that was a lie. He has not faced any particular discipline for this. He continues to do his job, which he apparently views as continuing to harass this poor newspaper carrier. There was a judicial hearing this week looking on whether to extend a temporary anti-harassment order that had been filed last month by an attorney for the newspaper carrier, a guy named Cedric Altheimer. And Altheimer is suing both Troyer and Pierce County over the confrontation in January 2021. So in issuing a ruling on Monday, Pierce County judge extended that anti-harassment order against Ed Troyer, require him to stay 1,000 feet from the from Altheimer for the next year.
Yeah, the judge expanded it from 500 feet to 1,000 feet because yes. Troyer had been engaging in things like now keep in mind that Altheimer's doing his paper route in the middle of the night, like 4 a.m., right?
Yeah.
And Troyer's getting up early to get in his pickup truck and follow him around, flash his lights, and harass him while he's doing his job. Okay.
Yes,
and
intending to get to all those things.
Yeah. It just defies understanding why Troyer is allowed to continue to do this.
Yeah. And, you know.
Why he's not in jail. Sure.
Yeah, exactly. And again, you know, there is no built-in accountability for a misbehaving sheriff because it's an elected office. So it's not like, say, the county executive can take action because Troyer answers literally to nobody except voters. And it's a 4-year term, so he's only a year and a half in. So Pierce County is apparently stuck with him for another 2 years, which is really bad news for Pierce County. If Troyer thinks that this is such a priority to harass this guy that he's getting up at, you know, 3 a.m. or something to go after him, that's a problem. And, you know, what's the redress for that problem? What's the redress if he refuses to abide by the anti-harassment order? Which, you know, as a law enforcement officer, he gets a lot of leeway in terms of deciding which court orders to abide by and which he doesn't. So we'll see if the court tries to hold him accountable, because that appears to be the only hope for any kind of oversight on this situation. But Troyer desperately needs not to have that kind of power because he's clearly abusing it.
Well, perhaps a recall vote, since those seem to be fairly popular on the West Coast currently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we'll see.
All right, moving on, this week's pandemic developments.
Yeah, well, the biggest news in terms of the pandemic, we've got another couple of Omicron subvariants that are becoming more prevalent in the United States. We've talked about this before. These were the subvariants that came to light in South Africa, BA4 and BA5. This is distinct from BA1 and the subvariant of BA1, BA1.12, and BA2. This is BA4 and BA5. And they, again, appear to be more transmissible, and they are they're getting a foothold in Europe now, and they're getting a foothold in the United States, particularly in Florida. But the prevalence of it has gone from practically nothing in about this time last month to 13% nationally, which means it's starting to become more prevalent around the country. We have not seen a lot of it that I've seen anyway in Washington State, but that's an inevitability, right? We've seen this arc before with other subvariants where first it spreads to Europe and then the United States, and people say, oh, it's not going to be that big a deal. And next thing you know, it's the dominant subvariant or variant. So, the the takeaway from this is, unlike the summer of 2020 and the summer of 2021, we are not likely to see a marked decline in the rate of new cases of COVID-19 in the summer of 2022. And this raises the question once again of why we are seeing businesses and government agencies basically send people the messaging that the pandemic is over, because it's not over. You know, the problem with variants and subvariants that are more likely to spread is that even though on average the cases may be milder, if you've got a large number of cases, that means a certain number of cases are going to be deadly. And again, we're seeing this nationally, and we're seeing this in Washington State, where hospitalizations, as we heard from the Washington Hospital Association this week, are up. And the number of serious cases are up. You know, we have better ways to treat this now than we did 2 years ago, certainly. And the rate of vaccination among people is gradually increasing. Although, again, a lot of people who are getting COVID at this point have been vaccinated, but they haven't gotten boosters. And Omicron and all of its subvariants do not respond to the just the first two shots from the vaccine, which is what is still considered by the CDC to mean you're fully vaccinated. You're not. You need to have a booster also. And the boosters provide very good protection against Omicron. But for whatever reason, you know, the messaging has been that the pandemic is over, no need to worry about it. And the rate of adults in the United States who've had boosters is still hovering around 30%. That's not good enough. So if you haven't gotten both the initial two shots of vaccine and the boosters, and again, we're getting to the point where one booster isn't enough because the length of coverage of those boosters is fairly limited. It's 6 to 9 months, basically. So if you got a booster, you know, this time last year, you need another booster. And you're eligible for it. So, and they're readily available. So, go get yourself protected and continue to wear masks in indoor spaces.
Yeah. I have my booster scheduled for next week.
Oh, good for you.
My second booster.
Right.
I got my first one last December.
Yeah. I got my second one, I think in January. So it's getting close to the time where I will need a fifth booster, or a third booster, I should say. So, yeah, you just got to stay on it. And this, again, this goes to the part of the rhetoric from political figures that is fairly accurate, which is that this is going to be an ongoing problem for the foreseeable future. And it's something that's going to become endemic, and you're just going to have to stay on top of it the way we do with flu vaccines every fall.
Mm-hmm. Well, big production this week with the January 6th hearings.
Yeah, and I should say that there were a lot of important takeaways from those hearings. I was highly amused this morning to see that of all the revelations that, for instance, the committee is trying to make the case, and I think fairly effectively, that Donald Trump himself was at the center of the planning for the January 6th riot and all of various efforts to overthrow the U.S. government that he took post-election to try and install himself as a permanent president. So in the midst of all that, Trump's reaction to the Thursday evening hearing was to deny his daughter Ivanka's claim that she told him that he had lost the election. As people who lived through the Donald Trump presidency may remember, there is nothing more precious to him than his daughter, who he has said in the past that he would love to date. And I don't even want to try and go into the psychology of that other than to say it's really icky. And that is the technical term, icky. Of all the revelations that basically Trump, committed sedition, that he was trying to overthrow the U.S. government, even though he was president at the time. And he was trying to use the powers of that office in order to you know, install himself as basically a permanent president and overthrow U.S. democracy, such as it is, that it's more important to him to maintain the illusion that, you know, he's in love with his daughter or whatever it is. That is a pretty good summation of the pathology of Donald Trump. But, you know, the actual presentation Thursday evening and the promises of what will be put forward in the remaining five public hearings was that, you know, Trump was trying to overthrow the U.S. government and that he should not be allowed anywhere near the reins of power in the future. He was clearly heavily involved in the planning. And as I think Liz Cheney was the one who pointed out that not only did he not intervene during for 3 hours during the course of the riot while rioters were going through the U.S. Capitol, but he also didn't try to call the National Guard. He did not try to marshal any additional law enforcement officers, which he was in a position to do, and he didn't do any of that. And you have to ask yourself why. Certainly for a committee hearing in Congress, the presentation got relatively high ratings, although it was about a half of what Joe Biden got for his State of the Union address. But there will be additional hearings. The next one is coming up on Monday. Tune into that, because this is important stuff. We need to have an accurate accounting of what actually happens so that, in the words of Chair Bernie Thompson, it can't happen again. And right now, the risk is very high that it could happen again, because one of the two major political parties in the U.S. is working very hard to ensure that it does happen, that we do lose our democracy. You know, the Republicans really are doing everything possible to undermine the electoral process and to install authoritarianism as the default, or de facto, I should say, political system that we have. So it's good to see primarily Democrats, along with Liz Cheney and Adam Kissinger, push back on this. I thought the presentation was relatively effective, and we'll see where it goes from here and what the public response is.
Yeah, I also thought it was a very good presentation too, and definitely worth watching. If you've not seen it, you can go online and find numerous videos. It'd be great to go to the website of a trusted news source, or even just a mainstream news source like the Washington Post or the New York Times or whatever, and you can see the videos there without them being edited or
right,
things inserted or deleted
or being spun. Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you saying that you don't trust the New York Times and the Washington Post?
Well, yeah, I do. And they actually present the videos. I think I was looking at the Washington Post. I was looking at the videos on Washington Post. They present them in order in these nice chunks that make them easy to follow and easy to digest.
Yeah.
And I thought the presentation was very effective.
Mm-hmm. I did too.
Yeah, and you really have to wonder about a man like Donald Trump who can say, oh, my employees at the time, Bill Barr, the attorney general, oh, he was lying. He didn't tell me that there was no basis to the fact that there was fraud during the election, you know. But you have to wonder about a man who will then say, my daughter was lying to me. My son-in-law was lying to me. Everyone was lying to me, right? And that was Donald Trump essentially saying, oh, you know, all of these people have testified now that they told him that there was no basis to the fact that there was fraud during the election and that he potentially could have won. They were all saying, no, it was a clean election. You were voted out of office. And he just ignored them all.
Yep.
He basically said, no, you're wrong. You're wrong. You're wrong. You're wrong. You're lying. Yeah. You're lying. You're lying. You're lying. That's a problem.
The other interesting thing out of the hearings was the the footage by an embedded British war journalist who decided the next major war, I guess, was going to be in the United States. So he had embedded himself with the Proud Boys in the days leading up to January 6th. And he caught on tape a meeting between the leader of the Proud Boys and the leader of the Oath Keepers. Now, this was particularly important in the context.
In a parking garage, like, you know, yes. deep throat style.
Exactly. I was thinking of that too, Deep Throat. So, anybody who's seen All the President's Men knows what we're talking about.
Yeah.
That was particularly important because the leader of the Proud Boys was charged on Monday with seditious conspiracy along with six other leaders of the Proud Boys. This was evidence of the conspiracy, right? Because he was conspiring with the leaders of the Oath Keepers and they were coordinating their efforts to try and basically ransack the U.S. Capitol. And doing so, you know, not because they stood anything to gain from it, but because, Donald Trump wanted them to.
Yeah. And not as an expression of free speech, as they'll tell you, oh, it was, you know, our free speech rights. That was not what their intent was not to exercise free speech. It was to overthrow the results of the election, to target specific members of Congress for violence. It was a coup attempt, a violent overthrow of the U.S. government and to disrupt the democratic process. And they were pre-planning it.
And the open question, which there's been some independent reporting on this in the last year or so, is whether they were working also with members of the White House staff to do that. And that's something I'm going to be looking for in the future hearings. You know, were the leaders of the Oath Keepers and Proud Boys and Three Percenters and the rest of those, were they in communication with the White House ahead of time about what to do on January 6th?
Yeah. Now, isn't the January 6th committee going to be putting together their argument that is in fact what happened, that members of the White House and perhaps even members of the Republican Party in Congress were working to try to overthrow the results of the election?
That's what various members of the committee have said.
And that Donald Trump, rather than trying to help the Capitol Police deal with the January 6th violence, that he actually encouraged the Oath Keepers and other folks who were there at the Capitol to engage in more violence.
And not only that, but there is also this open question of why the Capitol Police and why D.C. Metro Police and other law enforcement agencies didn't staff up adequately for what they knew was going to be a very large and potentially violent crowd. I can tell you, as somebody who in the past organized a lot of protests in D.C., that it was absolutely shocking, the lack of protection on January 6th. Usually you have to go through, you know, for an event of that size, you have to go through lines and lines of law enforcement officers from, you know, multitudinous different agencies. There's something like 20 different federal agencies that have jurisdiction in U.S. parks. You know, the park police, obviously were entirely missing. The Capitol Police were grossly understaffed. For not just for a violent protest, but for any protest where thousands of people are expected in the area around, you know, the important buildings, like, you know, the Capitol and White House and so forth. It was amazing how easy it was for the protesters to breach U.S. Capitol. Usually you cannot get within a block of the Capitol, for an event that size. So, yeah, that needs to be answered, too, because those orders probably came down from on high. You know, don't adequately staff, you know, or keep.
Or stand down.
Yeah, stand down. It's going to be a peaceful protest. Stand down. We're not expecting any trouble. That's what our intelligence says, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, somewhere that chain of command failed entirely to relay, for example, the alarm bells were going off at the FBI in particular, that this was a potentially very violent day. Because, you know, the pro-Trump people were not making any secret of it. They were talking openly about this on you know, the right-wing social media for months ahead of time.